Welcome to the podcast series from the EMN Slovakia 2022 National Conference entitled Dignified Labour Conditions as a Tool to Fight Modern Slavery, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You are listening to the presentation on the role of employers in upholding the human and labour rights of foreign workers by Philip Hunter. Philip serves as the head of the Labour Migration Unit at IOM headquarters in Geneva, where his focus includes migrant worker protection, ethical recruitment, as well as private sector and supply chain engagement. Prior to joining IOM, Philip served at a variety of positions at the International Labour Organization Enverite, a non-profit that promotes safe migration and the right of migrant workers in the global economy. Enjoy the presentation.
My name's Philip Hunter. I'm going to take us down a little bit of a path, focusing on topics quite different from what we've looked at in the previous two sessions. Not in the thematic sense, we're not straying away from labor exploitation, modern slavery, human trafficking issues, but looking at a perhaps different set of stakeholders. In this case, very specific, the private sector and the role of employers in addressing these issues. And I guess the main point that I want to leave with you today, or that I hope you take away with you, is that there's a great deal. There's an entire universe of work that's happening within the space of business and human rights by employers, by chambers of commerce, by employer organizations and industry associations, by global brands in particular. And that while there is that much work going on, and I hope to give you just a little bit of a sense of that work today, there's still so much more work to be done, not least in partnership with organizations like those that are here in the room today, IOM, governmental bodies, etc. So I'm going to walk you through some of the specific risks and motivations for the private sector to engage on these topics. Why are they even dealing with them in the first place? Just to lay the foundation for a bit of a discussion on what business has been doing, I'll stretch it back to the early 1990s. Hopefully that doesn't show my age to you too much. But we need to go back to the relatively early beginnings of the of this topic, when it was then called corporate social responsibility. It's now increasingly called business and human rights, or the business and human rights agenda. And I'll give you a little bit of a flavor of that history, for you to also understand why it's so important for us to be talking about these issues now and how we can best capitalize on the existing momentum. And then I'm going to end with a little bit of thoughts towards the future to tell you a little bit of the gaps that continue to exist in this space and perhaps inspire a little bit of discussion about how we can collectively help to fill those gaps with employers, with civil society, with governments at the table, of course, and of course with academia and intergovernmental organizations as well. But I want to start with some questions first to you, actually, and I'm going to rely on you to please be as interactive as possible and ask me questions as I go through rather than leaving it to the end. But I wanted a show of hands in the room, just for me to understand who's in the room. How many of you would say that you work in the business and human rights space? In business and human rights, yes. Business and human rights on this thematic area. So there's a good number. Great. And how many of you feel that you have a strong understanding of private sector engagement? Not so much. A little bit. Okay, that's good, because I wasn't going to go too deeply into the weeds. Plus, I think 40 minutes doesn't allow me to get too deeply into the weeds, but that's good to know. 30 minutes. I've just shaved off one slide. And then lastly, how many of you engage with employers regularly as part of your work? Do you work day in and day out, week in and week out with employers? Are you an employer or private sector representative yourself? Okay, so there's a good amount. Great. That just helps me better understand where we are in the room, and I can tailor my comments to you or with you a little bit more appropriately. So I said I was going to survey a little bit the history. What I want to emphasize to you is a few different, let's say, trends within the space of business and human rights. First, from a thematic focus. So we're here today to talk about labor exploitation, the counter-trafficking agenda, let's say forced labor, modern slavery, in the business and human rights space, it's not where the conversation started. It's where we are today, which is why it's so important for us to be here today and to think about how we can leverage private sector engagement on these topics. But I'd like to say that this area of work for the private sector began in the early 1990s with a very, very strong focus on what that at that time was called the sweatshop campaigns, typically driven by investigative journalism, which is, continues to be the case, driven by civil society actors, driven by the labor movement, driven in some cases by regulatory actors as well, looking at global supply chains in the broadest sense, and looking at conditions like occupational safety and health, looking at conditions of sexual harassment in the workplace, looking at various other labor and human rights issues, all under the rubric or under the umbrella term of sweatshops. That quickly moved or became a little more precise towards the late 1990s with a very strong focus on child labor. And that, I would say, I would probably argue was driven in part by the adoption of the Worst Forms of Child Labor Convention by the ILO in the late 1990s. It helped not only the global policy community to put a finer point on that issue in particular, and many of you will remember the red card against child labor campaign, which in some ways is ongoing, but it's apropos to talk about that given the FIFA World Cup at the moment. But a very, very strong focus. Of course, that didn't mean there wasn't ongoing interest and focus on occupational safety and health issues, but that there was a finer point in the business and human rights space to look at worst forms of child labor in the broadest sense. Fast forward a little into the early 2000s, and we see an additional or a new shift towards the issue of human trafficking. Again, I would say inspired probably by the adoption of the Palermo Protocol, and at that time, a very, very strong focus of bringing the private sector into the conversation about what they can, what business can do in a supply chains context, primarily against trafficking. At that time, in the early stages, it was about trafficking against sexual exploitation. But as we move through the 2000s towards 2010, we see increasingly the business community looking at trafficking for labor exploitation, which brings us to the issue of forced labor, which I would say from around the 2010s onwards is the primary focus of the business community on these topics right now. Now, what's happened in the time between 2010, 2012 until today, just to bring us up to date, is what our first speaker actually referred to, is that recognition that within the global estimates looking at forced labor, modern slavery, we're talking about a huge risk for migrant workers. That's reflected in the business and human rights space with an increasing interest, I would say, from 2015 onwards, looking at forced labor, but looking at forced labor specifically in terms of the risks to migrant workers in supply chains. That's the first bullet point. I think I might need to speed up just to make sure that I don't run too far over time. So I hope that gives you a sense of that sweep of thematic focus. At the same time, in parallel to that, where the sweatshop campaigns typically looked at apparel production only, apparel and footwear, let's say, with a very strong regional focus, maybe on Latin America, Central America, what we've seen in the sweep of time since then is a massive proliferation of interest in the business and human rights community looking at all sectors. So we see increasing initiatives focused on agriculture. We see initiatives focused on construction. We see initiatives, of course, focused on the electronics industry, palm oil in particular, when you look at specific agricultural commodities. And the list goes on from there, which is very, very encouraging for us, but also very, very difficult for us to keep track of the proliferation of those different initiatives. Lastly, we've seen some very, very important developments, really important developments to emphasize that move us from the early years, the 1990s, the adoption of supply chain codes of conduct, basically policies that companies adopt themselves, which at that time were considered, this is going to solve all the problems in sweatshops. We'll just adopt a policy and everything is going to be great in the factories that produce our goods around the world. Of course, that proved not to be the case. The simple adoption of a policy doesn't tend to change things quite as quickly as everyone might like. And so we've seen also a strategic shift or a shift in the way companies engage, looking more and more practically into things like social audits, risk assessments, what increasingly called due diligence now, looking also at greater impact and access to remedy for migrant workers, but for workers in general, transparency efforts to tell the world what companies are doing, what the private sector is doing, etc., as well as a shift from companies doing things on their own towards companies doing things in partnership. So I've just given you the sweep of the last 30 years, I would say, in the business and human rights space. There are a lot more details in this, but what I want to emphasize to you is that we're in a very interesting place, because we're in a place where business is increasingly interested in partnership. They're increasingly interested in impact and results for workers in particular. They're increasingly interested across all aspects, all parts of the global economy, and they're increasingly interested specifically in the topic that we're here to talk about today, not least because they continue to face increased scrutiny and pressure from various stakeholder groups. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a flavor of why our conversation here in terms of the private sector is really timely. Now, very briefly, in terms of understanding how business sees this issue that we're here talking about today through the risk lens, understanding global companies, supply chain employers, companies that are outside of that framework but still producing or providing services for national markets, local markets. The typical way these issues are looked at is from the lens of risk. For those companies that are looking at these topics, looking at risks to migrant workers, they're also looking at risks to their business operations, risks to their supply chain operations. Absolutely vital. Most importantly, the reputational risks that may come with finding themselves with global media coverage of poor conditions of work in a palm oil plantation, for example, in an electronics factory, on a construction site, in a hotel, etc., etc. There's a great deal of work that's being done in own operations, in those operations that are actually owned by specific businesses. That can be a hotel, it can be a retail site, it can be a construction site. But the vast majority of work is being done in the supply chains context. So when I asked you earlier about how many work in this space day to day, seeing that some put their hands up, but most did not, this helps me to understand how much I need to clarify in terms of the terminology. When you think about supply chains, typically the terminology you hear is about different levels of supply chains. The first tier, the second tier, the third tier. Of course, there are many steps in between, but that's the common framework that we use, or levels of analysis that we use to better understand where businesses fit in a supply chains context. The first tier is that final workplace that sells a finished product to a global company that then sells it to us. So if you think about it in terms of the clothes that we're wearing, the first tier of a supply chain is the factory that produces that piece, makes it ready for selling to the global company, where we then go to their retail outlets to buy that product itself. You go below that, let's say to the second tier, and you're talking then about different types of companies, typically a little bit smaller. Maybe they produce the buttons. Maybe they produce the thread. Maybe they produce a little bit of embroidery that goes on to the product that we buy, etc. One step further from the global company and one step into a more murky area of labor and human rights issues. Finally, the third tier is maybe where the cotton is produced or the rubber comes from that goes into our shoes, it goes into our clothing, etc. I won't go into more detail there. There's a lot of detail to go into that, but just to understand that there's a tremendous amount of work being done in this space. Lastly, a new area of work, as if you think about supply chains vertically, step one, step two, step three, tier one, tier two, tier three, increasingly, companies are also looking at their horizontal business relationships. So the relationships that they have with cleaning services, the relationships they have with transport services, the relationships they have with retail outlets that sell their products but are not branded their own, their relationship with security services. In each of these places, of course, migrants are very present. Statistically, there's greater proportion of migrants in the services sector than there is in manufacturing, for example. This is only an area of work where a tremendous amount of work needs to be done. Only a little bit is being done at the moment. But to give you a sense, it's seen as a risk to the companies that are working on this topic. So we've covered a little bit about the history, the overall context. We've covered a little bit about the motivations for why the private sector is working on these topics, why they're a potential partner for us as we look at this and take our work forward. Now I want to very briefly talk, although this is a very packed slide, so it may be difficult to be brief, but I want to talk a little bit about the employer response. So we've talked about the risks. We know about the risks to migrant workers. We know about the different forms of exploitation that were so fully covered by our first speaker. What are companies actually doing? So I want to give you this sense that a tremendous amount of work is being done already, but of course that much more needs to be done. I've divided the slide into two columns, one looking at product supply chains, so that vertical side, tier one, tier two, tier three, and the second column looking at a very, very important area of work that is under-scrutinized by the private sector typically, and that is the recruitment process, the labor migration process through which migrants actually get into workplaces. An absolutely massive failure within this business and human rights space historically has been the gap in looking at how people get into workplaces, particularly those that cross borders, but even those that cross internal borders, let's say in a large country like Canada or a large country like India or China. What are the processes through which people get into work, and who are the various, who's the constellation of actors that are responsible for that movement, and where do the abuses potentially happen? That area of work has just started in the last 10 years, and I would say we're just still at the very, very beginning stages of that. What I want to emphasize here, however, is that work is being done, particularly on the left-hand side of the slide in the product supply chains. I've mentioned codes of conduct and supply chain policies as having their origins already in the early 1990s. I think Levi's, Strauss & Company was the very first one in 1992 to adopt a modern version of a code of conduct looking at supply chain compliance or supply chain conditions. The adoption of that policy was really, really important. That the adoption of that policy from a perspective of a global company is absolutely central to having, let's say, global buy-in within that company. But it was quickly recognized that much more needed to be done by companies if they were actually going to change conditions within their supply chains. And that's where the next few bullets on this slide actually come in. The assessment of working conditions in given workplaces around the world. Let's say you're Levi's, Strauss, and you know that you're sourcing from Honduras or Guatemala in the early 1990s. What are the conditions like for workers in those factories? The adoption of a policy is not going to change those unless it's followed up with that type of oversight or monitoring, as well as, of course, corrective action in cases where problems are found. So we see increasing focus on assessments, risk assessments in the workplace itself, as well as, let's say, assessments that look at regions as a whole, where to target those types of workplace assessments. All of this comes under increasingly the topic of due diligence. What's also been a very, very strong push is engaging directly with supply chain employers. So working with them, training them, raising their awareness, helping them improve their own policies and practices, helping them establish grievance mechanisms, for example, in the workplace, helping them work through traditional industrial relations schemes to work with organized labor in the workplace more effectively to address potential abuses in those workplaces. Of course, corrective action and access to remedy, I've already mentioned. A lot of work going into that, especially now. We're seeing a certain amount of work being done to elevate worker voice in the supply chains context, although too little. I would say too little. We're still at the very, very early stages of that. and conceptually what that actually means, what it means to elevate or promote worker voice in a workplace context, in a regional context, in a corridor context, what that actually means, we haven't figured out yet, or companies have not figured out yet. But there are tremendous partnership opportunities in that space for us to engage together to improve that work. I've mentioned reporting and transparency. There will be many in the room, I'm sure, that are at least familiar with a lot of reporting efforts under modern slavery legislation, for example. And then, of course, partnerships. The more interesting, from IOM's perspective, the more interesting area of work in the supply chains context is the other side of the slide. And that's the nascent work that's been done just over the last decade to look at how people are getting into workplaces, the recruitment practices, the various recruitment actors that are involved in the cross-border movement of workers, and the conditions of that recruitment. We've already heard a lot about recruitment fees and costs. We've heard about debt bondage. We've heard about those sorts of things. What does that mean from the perspective of the company? What risk does that pose for the company? And how do they actually engage? It's, again, a whole other area of work that was completely absent up until 5 to 10 years ago and is now an increasing area of work. Very interesting, and the tremendous potential for our work going forward. The response has been very much mirrored by the product supply chains area of engagement, the adoption of policies, the implementation of various forms of assessment, the training and capacity building for suppliers about recruitment practices, the training and capacity building to a certain extent for recruiters themselves that are integrated into the supply chain, the adoption of things like hotlines, counter-trafficking hotlines are the best example, other forms of technology, use of technology, smartphones to get information to workers as one way of elevating worker voice, as well as establishing these forms of grievance mechanisms. The repayment of fees is an absolutely massive area of work, and Apple, the company Apple, is the one that gets the most profile, and I think their recent report indicated that over the last 10, 15 years of working on this topic, they had facilitated the repayment of more than $35 million US dollars to workers who had been charged recruitment fees and costs within their supply chain. Modern slavery statements, in terms of the reporting and transparency requirements, I've mentioned modern slavery statements already. All right, so that's a sweep of the business response. We've talked a little bit about the history, a little bit about the risks to business and why they're engaged. I've given you a sense of how they're engaged, how they've responded from the 1990s forward and more recently on this topic of ethical recruitment. Are there any questions? Thank you.
This presentation was part of the 2022 EMN Slovakia National Conference. The conference was organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. The European Migration Network is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.